Empower Radio presents The Farkas Files, an exploration of energy, metaphysics, and the paranormal with David Franklin Farkas. The Farkas Files. The truth is in here, somewhere. Here's your host, David Franklin Farkas.
Good evening. Thanks so much for being with us once again tonight. And I know most of you are listening at other times, but there are the folks who are listening and will be in their way participating in this tonight. And that's very exciting because we have a wonderful guest. My guest tonight is Andras Corbin Arthen, who is, he doesn't want me to call him an expert, but he's an expert about paganism. And he'll tell you more and I'll tell you more, but I've been wanting to have this conversation about what is paganism and some of the misunderstandings about it for a very long time. So I'm really excited that we connected and we'll be able to talk tonight. But first, tonight's metaphysical musing. I talk about this all the time. You know, people walk around doing what we used to call in the old neighborhood their sidewalk act. You know, I'm going along, everything's fine, nothing's bothering me, and there's all kinds of other stuff going on, but they're not going to let on to that. And a big part of that right now is the shift in the frequency of the planet. And that's kind of sounds airy-fairy, ascension, you know, what does all that mean? And I've talked about it before that the planet is rising in vibration, and so are all of us. And it's like all of us getting a healing every day. So all kinds of things come up, bubble to the surface to be healed. But the part that isn't clear to a lot of people is that it's happening on the physical plane as well. So while everybody is fussing over the polar vortex and what it means and whether it's, you know, a liberal plot or whatever the conservative TV folks are messing around with, the sun gave off an X-class solar flare. X-class flares are rare and they're the most powerful solar flares. And they send out this huge, basically, burst of energy, burst of particles. It takes, I don't remember how long, a day or so, to get to the Earth. And then it does all kinds of stuff. It makes all kinds of things wonky in electronics. It affects satellites. But it, in a very profound way, affects each one of us. It affects our emotions, affects how our physical body feels, all kinds of other stuff. So, and, you know, my friend Claudia McNeely, who's been on the show many times, often talks about how people will actually feel hot or feel fiery in various ways when there's a major solar flare. There's all kinds of changes that are going on. So I just want to encourage everybody to be paying attention to the fact that when you're feeling weird, it may not be just that some random thing is going on or you're getting a cold or, you know, your body is aching in the way that it always ached. It's not just that. There really are things changing on this planet that are powerful and profound, and it's affecting all of us. And there are going to be days when you're feeling weird. And, you know, if you're not paying attention to those factors, if you don't happen to be online somewhere where they talk about solar flares or other stuff, you wouldn't notice that. An example of that that's a bit more personal sensitivity, a gal that I know used to call me up and say, I don't know what's going on. I'm totally despondent this morning. I got up and I'm crying. And I feel like somebody died. And it took us about 6 months to figure out that anytime there was a major, usually natural disaster, where lots of mothers and children were either in danger or had been suddenly killed, she felt it in her body and in her emotions. And it got to the point where she would call me up and I'd say, let's go online and look at CNN or some other news feed and see where the disaster is today. And then we can send it light and we can pray about it. But at least you'll know it's not that you're crazy today. It's that you are hypersensitive to this particular kind of thing on the planet. and you're the canary for this. So each one of us has those sensitivities, and as you learn what they are, number one, you'll know that when it's going on, you can just say, oh, I'm not crazy, this thing is going on. But also it allows you to focus on whatever it is that needs to be healed and do whatever you do in your healing practice in order to shift that energy. So just encouraging you to realize there's a whole lot going on right now. So that's tonight's metaphysical musing. And now we get to spend some delightful time with Andras Corbin Arthin. Hey, Andras, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing fine, David. How are you?
I'm great. And I know we got to talk for like a minute before we got on, and I said you were my expert on paganism, and you were kind of going, no. But and I understand that. On the other hand, you've got a pretty unique background in terms of where you come from and what you've learned and what you're doing now, the organizations you've been involved in, all kinds of things. So you do speak from, you know, an incredible background and profound knowledge. So why don't you, I ask everybody who's on the show to tell us about their walkabout and their path, but also fill us in on all these things that you've done and all the groups that you're plugged into.
Okay, well, let me just clarify, first of all, that the reason I said I'm not really an expert is that in many ways there really isn't such a thing, I don't think,
sure,
as an expert in paganism, because paganism is a subject that is so vast and complex and has, you know, it's so full of diverse permutations and so on and so forth, that it's very difficult for any single individual to really have a handle on the whole thing. But I have a pretty good handle on it. I've been around for a while. So how this started for me, I think, well, I guess that I'd have to go back to my earliest childhood. And I was born in Galicia in Spain, and was raised there, and then my family moved to the Caribbean, and I lived in Cuba and Puerto Rico for a number of years, and eventually moved here. But when I was a small child, I suffered from these periodic bouts of very intense fevers that would appear for no discernible reason, and they could not diagnose them, but very, very high fevers lasting several days, and then I'd be fine, and there were no other symptoms, there was nothing else. And as I got older and was able to speak, I would tell my parents about how when I had those fevers, there would be these beings that would appear to me that were seemingly made of light. I call them the shining ones in Spanish, because they seem to give off this light from within, and they were not people, they were not human figures, they were these sort of strange shapes, but I knew that they were beings, and they were very complicated. I won't go into that in detail, but they communicated with me, they would tell me things, they would teach me things. They would take me places. In fact, you know, it was kind of funny, because they would take me places where I had never been in ordinary reality, and then I would talk to people who lived in those places as if I had been there and be able to tell them details and so on of those particular places that there was no way that I could know. So it was kind of a very odd thing, and and this happened for most of my childhood until I became an adolescent, at which point they sort of stopped for about 7 years or so. And the thing about those experiences, which as a child it was very difficult for me to put in any kind of context, and especially growing up Spanish Catholic. Right. You know, which, and this is, of course, back in the 50s, So it was a very old world kind of Catholicism. There was no room for any kind of thing like that unless you were a saint or something and had been dead for a couple of hundred years. I couldn't really explore that or had a context for it, but nevertheless, those experiences made a big impact on me and in many ways laid the foundation for what I wound up doing in my life later on. And for, you know, most of my adolescence, junior high, high school, nothing ever happened. And in fact, I almost forgot about these things. And by the time that I was about 16 or so, I decided that I really couldn't be Catholic anymore, that I did not believe in what the church taught, that it didn't make any sense to me. And that was true for all of Christianity, for that matter. So I decided to break away from it, which was also very difficult to do because everybody around me was, sure, was Catholic. I still felt something, you know, which I think pretty much everybody feels at some point in their lives, a sort of spiritual yearning, a vacuum that wanted to be filled by something. And I didn't know what that was. So in the late 60s, I moved up to Boston, as so many people do, to go to college. And of course, that was the time when the counterculture movement was in full swing. And the New Age movement was beginning, and there were all of these various kinds of outlets, spiritual outlets, if we can call them that, for a young person who was looking. And so I started exploring Buddhism and yoga and Sufism and all kinds of things like that. And, you know, they all had something important to offer me, but I couldn't quite get over the cultural gap because I felt like to really do justice to these various practices, I would need to go live in India for a while or go live in Japan or China or someplace, learn a different language, really steep myself in that culture. And I wasn't prepared to do that. So it was around that time that I happened by coincidence.
Yeah.
Through, you know, how those things are.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine at this place where I was working, I was putting myself through college by working as an office boy in this engineering firm. And this one guy who I had befriended, who was one of the younger and kind of a little alternative engineer, had longish hair and an earring and things like that back then. And he said to me, you know, there's these people that I know, these friends of mine that you really should meet because I think that you guys would really hit it off. And he told me that he knew this couple who were from Scotland, and mm-hmm. they were in the Boston area because they were doing graduate work at one of the local universities, and that they their family came from the Highlands, that they spoke Gaelic, and that they had these spiritual practices that were, as he put it, really, really out there. And he thought that they would have something in common with me. And, you know, one thing I guess I should mention is Galicia, the part of Spain that I'm from, is kind of like the last bastion of Celtic culture in Spain. So when I grew up, that was a big part of our culture, the music and the dances and, you know, the stories and so on and so forth. So I was getting also in a place of trying to recover my family identity as Galicians and as Celts. But I didn't know much about it. So hearing that these people were Celts from Scotland, I thought, well, you know, why not? And I remember that the last thing my friend said after he arranged the introduction, he said, he kind of, you know, stage whispered, be careful though, these people are witches. And mm-hmm. I thought, what do you mean by witches? You know, what does that have to do with anything? You know, witches don't exist. And, you know, Who in the 20th century would call herself or himself a witch? That's ridiculous. So that actually got me even more interested in meeting them, because I thought, you know, I want to meet these two very strange human beings who are kind of going to be out there and they're crazy and whatever. It should be fun. And when I met them, it was not at all what I expected. They were about twice my age, and they were very smart. They were very friendly, very accessible. And once we got going and they started telling me about where they came from, what their spiritual practices that had been maintained in their family for a very long time, from always, as they would say, there was something about them that felt right in a way that nothing else had felt right until then. And, you know, questions that I had formulated in my mind that I had never seen discussed anywhere before, they had the answers to those questions even before I asked them. And, you know, so that kind of thing, there was this sense of having found the people that I was supposed to be with. And so after getting to know each other over a couple of months, I eventually asked them if they would teach me, and they said yes. And that was my start. And what they practiced was something that, you know, it wasn't a religion in a formal sense, in that it really wasn't about beliefs. It was about gaining direct experiences of something spiritual, something powerful, something, transcendent, in a way that, you know, transcendent in the sense that it transcended ordinary human experience, not that it transcended the world. In fact, their practices were very grounded in the natural world, and the way they saw it, nature really was the great teacher. Mm-hmm. So that the basis of their spiritual practice was direct communion with the natural world. So it was, you know, to put it in a nutshell, it involved learning how to go into a deep experience of what we could call trance. They used a Gaelic term, which meant to be enmisted, to go into the mist, so to speak.
Ah.
And in that state, which is nowadays we might call it a liminal state, an in-between state, you open yourself to a natural environment and you commune and you experience what, not only what we normally perceive through our senses of nature, but also what lies beyond that. And we assimilate that, we internalize it, it changes us, and that's how we grow spiritually. And from their point of view, you know, we really come, nature is not something that we see and we touch and whatever. Nature is what we are. It's what we literally come out of and go back to at the end of our days. So nature is the matrix, the mother, really, in the most literal sense of the word. And that's kind of like the nutshell version of how I got here. There's a lot more to say, obviously, but let me shut up for a second and see if you have anything that you want to.
Well, I love that it started in Europe, went all over the world with you, and, you know, you're still having your experiences that you don't have a context for. And then in Boston during college, you find your teachers.
Right.
Right. You know, which is the kind of thing I love hearing, because there are so many stories like that, and saying, you know, when you're ready, the teacher is there. Mm-hmm. And I want to hear more about some of the other things you've done, just to fill things in, because you're part of organizations all over the world. But you, when I was reading the materials you sent me, you said something that really struck me as one of the questions I didn't know to ask. Because most of the pagans that I know are more neo or urban pagans.
Right.
And a lot of them identify themselves as witches. And what you said, and I had never heard it put that way before, is that witches are shamans in that tradition, that they function exactly like a shaman in any other tradition. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the tradition that I learned from was a Cherokee medicine man and somebody else who was trained in the Philippines by psychic surgeons. Uh-huh. So, my background is very much that shamanic perspective.
Sure.
And I understand what you're saying about going into that altered state and having a different experience and learning from everything around you, because that's the way I describe my training is that they would set up situations and then throw me in the deep end of the pool and see whether I drowned.
Right. Right. I hesitate to use the word shaman for myself just because I think the word shaman is one that gets both misused and overused in our culture nowadays.
Sure.
But if we think of shamanism in not the specific term of this practice that came from the Tungas in Siberia and so on,
right,
but from as a form of spirituality that deals directly with the spirit world, that is not a formal religion as such, and that is based on direct experience of spirit beings and what have you, which, you know, is in a way inaccurate, but it's a basic description.
Right.
That is really,
and it's also the individual who's identified in whatever way, a shaman or a witch or that indigenous healer, as being the part of that, being the person in that community that takes on that role and provides a certain kind of service to everyone in the community, that people look to and depend on that person to take care of certain kinds of needs. And that every culture all over the world has their version of that.
Right. Well, you know, my teachers did not use the word shaman ever.
Sure.
And they really didn't. I mean, they used the words witch and pagan, but mm-hmm. more as adjectives. They, you know, they had a term that is a Gaelic term that gets translated as witch oftentimes, and that certainly people in their communities or their families who had similar kinds of practices had been accused of witchcraft back in, you know, the days when people were looking for witches. But and you know, to them, pagan was really more of an adjective. It was not a self identity. They just did what they did. It had no name, and you know, so on. But it really was all about the experiences. And during my training with them, I went through some experiences that were just so intense and so unequivocally, otherworldly. There was just no way to explain the things that I experienced, that I had a choice of agreeing to believe them or not and be in denial. But I, you know, couldn't very well believe something that was so physical and tangible.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things that I did fairly early on in my training is that they had a couple of beings that they were connected with that take the form. This is my long way of explaining this. That take the form of what in the ordinary world we call mushrooms. I have too much respect for these beings to just say, well, they're mushrooms, and everybody thinks, oh yeah, shrooms, you know, big deal. It's, you know, these are very powerful beings that are very alive, very ancient, very wise. And my first experience with one of these beings, which came much sooner than normally it would happen, except that it very clearly chose me for whatever reason. It was by far the most traumatic, horrifying, shattering experience of my life. You know, having grown up Spanish Catholic, I had this really good idea of what hell would be, and hell was nothing compared to what this felt like, you know. Yeah. And but the end result was that it, you know, in a matter of a few hours, I became a different person.
Yeah.
And it really changed me. And so, you know, those kinds of experiences. And then after my teachers left and I began looking for other people that might have similar kinds of practices, I started coming into contact with people of members of the pagan movement, which was something I was not aware of, that there was this what was gradually growing as a movement in those days of people who identified with the label pagan and who were attempting to recreate or practice, or in some cases sort of, you know, reinvent some of the old pre-Christian traditions, mostly of Europe. And as I met them, I found that, you know, we had a lot in common in terms of where we were coming from and what we were seeking. But in terms of the specifics, it wasn't a good fit for some reason. You know, it was just not really. Most of the people who practiced paganism saw paganism as a religion. As a religion of nature and so on and so forth. And they, you know, there were people who would say things like, you know, witchcraft was the religion of pre-Christian peoples in Europe, you know, and that witches were priestesses and priests of that religion and what have you. And that didn't quite fit what I had been taught. And so I started to do a good bit of research and trying to understand what I had been taught. And around that time, incidental to what you were saying before about your own experience, I met this guy. I spent about 7 years at Harvard University working and taking graduate courses and so on. And I was friends with some people from the Native American Student Association. And through them, I met this guy who was a medicine man of the Seneca people in Western New York State. And we hit it off and had this great conversation. And he was, ironically, the first and only American Indian medicine person that I ever met who called himself a shaman. But he used medicine man and shaman interchangeably.
Right.
And he told me two things that really made a big impact on me. He said, "I think what you were taught was a form of shamanism. It seems very similar to shamanism." And I knew what that was, but that was before the whole current, you know, Shaman's Drum and Michael Harder and people like that. So there was nothing accessible to find out. And the other thing he said was, "I think you have inherited a native practice, you know, something that is native the way that my practice is native." And so those two things kind of gave me a pointer of where I might go further in trying to understand what I had been taught.
Well, that's the perfect turning point, and we're going to come back to it after the break. My guest is Andras Corbin Arthen, and tell everybody where they can find you. What's your website?
It's the Earth Spirit Community, and it's earthspirit.com. Earth Spirit is one word, so www.earthspirit.com.
Great, and we'll talk a little bit about what you're doing and Earth Spirit when we come back.
All right.
So this is a fascinating conversation for me on so many different levels, and I've got loads of questions, and I've got that question from somebody who at some point studied with you.
Oh, great.
Interesting question, actually. So we will be back shortly, unless we get taller, here on the Farkas Wilds. With Andras Corbin Arthen. Don't go nowhere. We're going to have some more fun. Stay with us.
This is the story of a boy wizard whose name was Larry Smarter.
Larry, why weren't you in Professor Dinky Doodle's mythical creature classification class?
Larry wanted to go to college, so he visited knowhowtogo.org to find which classes he really needed.
You missed the lesson on telling dragons from dragonflies.
Right. I want to go to college, so I'm taking Algebra 2, Biology, and a foreign language.
Foreign language? You mean so you can talk to unicorns?
Well, not exactly. Unless they're French.
But Larry had no time for unicorns, or even for Miss Petunia Tutti's time-traveling tutorial, which met every other yesterday at 25 o'clock.
Sorry I'm late. My snarkball game went into overtime.
And he knew knowhowtogo.org was way better than hoping for a snarkball scholarship. So, while his friends all aced invisibility, when Larry finally got to college, they were nowhere to be seen.
Brought to you by the American Council on Education, Lumina Foundation for Education, and the Ad Council.
Have you ever lost a cat? And have you ever wanted to get your cat back after you lost it? Hi there, I'm Andrew Hoffman. I went on this website called InventNow.org. Then I decided to make an invention of my own. It's called the Lost Cat Magnet Invention. So you can get your cat back after you lost it. Just turn it on, and lost cats stick to it. That's a good cat. If your cat was hiding up in a tree, it won't be up a tree anymore. It will be stuck to the lost cat magnet. And sometimes they fly toward you in the air. Just listen to one satisfied cat. See? That's proof. You should go to the InventNow.org website too. But just remember one thing. Don't do a lost cat magnet.
Anything's possible. Keep thinking. Get started on your own inventions or just play some games at InventNow.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the National Inventors Hall of Fame Foundation, and the Ad Council.
My name is Meera Batra. I have been in this country 32 years, and this is how I live united. America has always been the land of promise, and in my community, many families have come for a better life. Coming from another culture myself, I know the desire to become part of a community, to feel at home, and to gain the tools for our children and families to succeed. So I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to look beyond their histories and to see what opportunities are available. We help them get involved with their kids' schools, network within the community, and when we do, we unite them. We make the community stronger. What I do is something I wish someone had done for me, and I am so grateful I am able to. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunities and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give. Advocate. Volunteer. Live United. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Now back to the Farkas Files with David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio.
And we're back with my guest, Andras Corbin Arthin, and we're talking about paganism in all its many forms and trying to define the indefinable here. So you were talking before the break about, you know, how you got here and what you had learned. And you're talking about the medicine man that that you ran into, who recognized that what you were learning was an indigenous teaching. Much like what Native Americans have as their indigenous teachings. And I find all of that totally fascinating. Every time I hear about another part of the world where there is a profound shamanic, pagan, whatever we're going to name it, tradition and how similar they are, I just marvel at it. You know, the first time I realized that Tibetan Buddhism was a shamanic practice, it kind of blew my mind.
Right. Well, you know, for me, one of the things that happened after that particular conversation that really, you know, it's funny how sometimes we have an encounter or a conversation that it becomes a turning point in our lives. And so for me, that became the start of what is now a 35, 36-year long search for survivals of indigenous or ethnic pagan practices in Europe. And, you know, it's been a very long and very difficult search because most of what survives is held by very small communities of people, sometimes even just a family or two, in fairly remote places in Europe. Of the ones that I have been able to find, and I found several over that time, but what I've been able to find are they're all in rural locations, and in fact, usually in fairly remote and often in inhospitable rural locations, mountains and, you know, places like that. And they're very ethnically based. So they have a very specific culture where they still speak the old languages. And mm-hmm. those factors, I think, have been critical in enabling them to survive. And they generally survive by separating themselves from the main culture of whatever country they're in a meaningful way. They may still participate in the culture. They may still go to a Christian church every Sunday, and you know, so on and so forth. But they live double lives. So oftentimes their neighbors don't even know who these people are, and so right. And they tend to be very wary and very private and very protective. So that probably was the most difficult part of my search, was trying to find these people and then trying to find the people who knew them, that they trusted, who would trust me and would be able to make the introduction and so on. So currently I am hard at work on a book that documents, first of all, places paganism in the context of indigenous traditions worldwide. Because one of the things that, you know, we talk about indigenous people in the Americas, in Africa, in Australia, but nobody thinks of indigenous peoples in Europe. Right. And of course, there had to be, there were indigenous peoples. The question is, who were they? You know, and I think for that, we have to go to the people that existed in the European continent before it was even Europe, you know, as a concept, prior to Christianity. And we're really talking about people who were, you know, rural communities for the most part. We're not talking about city people. And I think mm-hmm. that's an important distinction that I finally came to realize, because when in general society, in general conversation, we talk about pagans, people think immediately of the Romans and the Greeks. But, you know, the Romans, the foundation of Roman culture was Rome, which was a huge city. And the, you know, Hellenic civilization really took place in city-states. So these were urban peoples. They were citified people. And in fact, it was, ironically, it was the Romans who coined the term pagan right. to describe the people who were not part of the city of Rome, who were the country folk. And so they saw themselves not as pagans, but as city people. There were urbani, and the pagani were kind of like the illiterate, poor, kind of, you know, rough and uncouth people living out there. Kind of like, you know, the distinction that people in Boston make toward those of us in Western Massachusetts, I think, especially at the state house level, I think. Don't you think? But
as someone else who lives in Western Massachusetts, yes. I know.
So it, you know, so it was a disparaging, despective term on the part of the Roman. So no self-respecting Roman would have called himself or herself a pagan. But if we look at the folk people, at the country people, the farmers, the shepherds, the herders, the herdsmen, the fishers, and so on and so forth, the salt of the earth kind of people, these were the peoples that really, you know, most fit the definition of pagan. So the original, and I think the most specific and accurate definition of pagan is not one of monotheism versus polytheism, or of Christianity versus everybody else, but in right. fact, it was actually a class distinction. It was the urban people versus the rural people. And so paganism really had to do with the rural spiritual practices these people held. So there is some that survives in Europe, even to this day, in some of these isolated communities. And I think it's important because we don't think, you know, most people think all of that went away a long time ago, and it's really not quite so. You know, and now for me, what that also led to was to trying to reach out to indigenous cultures from other places to talk to some of their leaders, some of their elders, some of their holy people, in the hope of trying to understand better what my practices were about. In the, you know, obviously, what a Hopi does and believes is not going to be you know, very similar necessarily to what a Gael from the Scottish Highlands would do. But there are certain similarities that are more important than that of somebody practicing something that is not indigenous. So in the process, I also founded the Earth Spirit Community, which is at this point one of the oldest and largest pagan organizations in the country, starting in 1977. And it's an organization that brings together people from diverse backgrounds who are interested in experiencing nature spirituality in whichever way it manifests. So we have a very diverse group of people, but that's kind of our yardstick. We have even have Christians who are very earth oriented. And we have events, we have classes, we have ceremonies, we have gatherings and conferences. We have artistic events, we have a web presence, and we have magazines and so on, you know, as a way to try to bring some of these people together.
Right.
In fact, we are having an event at the very end of this month in Northampton. It's called the Feast of Lights, and it's our winter event that happens at the Clarion Hotel in Northampton. And if you'd like to come, we'd be glad to have you.
Well, I definitely want to meet you, and I had not heard about that, but yes, I'll work that out.
Right.
That would be great fun.
Sure. And if people want to find out, they can go to our website and find out about it.
Which is earthspirit.com.
Earthspirit.com. And, you know, that also, that whole quest also led to getting involved in the ongoing interfaith dialogue that has been happening for quite a long time. Conversations among not just the large religions of the world, the main religions of the world, if you would, but really all religions. And all that started in 1893 in Chicago at the first Parliament of the World's Religions, which was an event that drew religious leaders not only from here and from Europe, but also they brought people from India and from China and Tibet and Japan and the Middle East. And they gathered together and had this big conference. And the famous Hindu saint, Swami Vivekananda, became sort of like the star of that event because, you know, he was a young man in his early 30s. But people could just sense his depth of spirit and his wisdom for his years. And he was very eloquent, and he became sort of like the spokesperson and the symbol for interreligious dialogue. So ever since, there's been this interfaith conversation going on in throughout the world, really. And we became involved with the Parliament of the World's Religions back in 1993. And so the Parliament, there's a council that runs the Parliament and every so many years organizes a new Parliament in a different city, often a different country. And we've been going to those ever since the early 90s. And in 2006, I was elected to the Board of Trustees of the Parliament. And I've been serving as a trustee in a number of capacities ever since. And it's really been a fascinating and very fulfilling work to meet all of these people from all over the world and to sit down with, you know, Christians and Buddhists and Jews and Muslims and Hindus and Zoroastrians and Baha'is and, you know, and talk not only about what we believe or what we practice and, you know, get to learn about each other and hopefully develop respect toward each other and understanding, but also really to, beyond that, to find ways to work together to try to address the world's most vexing problems. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really beautiful thing to see when people who, you know, I mean, you know, you talk about Jews and Muslims who people would tend to think, you know, they're at each other's throats, and you have, you know, rabbis and imams, you know, embracing and, you know, working together for the common good. It's just a very beautiful thing.
That's incredible. It's an incredible piece of work to put together to get that many different people from so many traditions in one place and basically see what happens. That's incredible. That's really wonderful.
You know, and these events draw like 10,000 people from all over the world, every race, every religion, every language. So they're really wonderful.
That's fantastic. Well, I want to make sure that I get this question from Walter, who's a Facebook friend of mine. Walter Weaving Eagle.
Oh, did you know that he made the cover of Rolling Stone magazine recently?
No.
Yeah, he did. It's right there on Facebook. He's on the cover of Rolling Stone, Walter.
I will have That's to ask very him impressive. About that. Yeah. he didn't tell me about that. And they're kind of interesting, strange questions. His first question was, where do you see paganism in 10 years? Which on one hand is like, how could you possibly answer that question? But in another way, in terms of a movement and being understood in the world and things like that, I think I understand what he's asking.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you where I hope to see it in 10 years. I think that there's a lot of wonderful potential to the pagan movement, and that there are also some inherent obstacles that we have to overcome. And, you know, the fact that paganism attracts so many people from so many different backgrounds, coupled with the fact that in Western culture, even in this country, it's really beginning to happen, people are moving away from mainstream organized religion and are looking for a spirituality that is much more practical and personal, and then coupled with the kind of environmental awareness that we are finally, you know, developing as a culture, I think the idea of people practicing a form of spirituality that is rooted in the natural world and in living in harmony with the natural world, and in seeing ourselves not as the owners or even as the stewards of the earth, but really just as intrinsically a part of the earth, as much as a tree is a part of the earth, or, you know, a bird is a part of the earth, or the sun is a part of, you know, nature in some way, you know, or the rain. That's a very attractive and powerful thing that many people are being drawn to. The flip side of that is, because there is so much diversity and because paganism is not centrally organized, it's become a lot harder for people to actually figure out how they can live this, how they can live a nature-centered spirituality in the midst of great cities, which in fact become shields between us and the natural world.
And trying to figure out which flavor of all of the different possibilities is the one that resonates for them.
Right.
Let me ask you Walter's second question, which is fascinating. He said, what can the silverbacks, the senior members of the craft, do to help the people? Which is, I think, a deeper question than it sounds.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think one of the things that I find fascinating is that in some of these European pagan survivals that I've found, as is true in with indigenous traditions elsewhere, the elders of the community play a very particular role. They may no longer be young and strong enough to go hunting or to go, you know, doing this or do that, but they are the people who keep the wisdom and keep the traditions and pass that on to others. And they are the people that, you know, the community goes to for counsel and guidance and so on and so forth. In modern paganism, because so much of the focus has gotten on the younger people, on you know, sort of like being cutting edge and so on and so forth, there often is a lack of awareness of the people who've been around a long time, who are, you know, the pagan elders, who hold a certain kind of experience and wisdom and memory that has value and that can be passed on. So in the modern pagan movement, when you see pagan elders or people who call themselves that, oftentimes it's people in their 30s and 40s who really are fairly new when it really comes right down to it. So and I know many people who started out about when I did in the late 60s who, you know, are forgotten and are, you know, they've sort of have gone away because nobody wanted to involve them. So I think that is actually something that we need to learn to do, is tap on the wisdom of our elders because there's a lot of good stuff there for the younger people to learn and to get passed on from one generation to the next.
Right. Right. I'm gonna give you, we don't really have time to get into it, but I wanted to tell you one little piece, and maybe we can talk about it when we meet in Northampton.
Sure.
My family, my father's family, are Sephardic Jews. Mm-hmm. So that's the Judaism of Spain.
Right.
And the Inquisition was targeting Jews, so the Sephardim fled across Europe. And in the case of my family, got as far as the Carpathian Mountains and settled there in what became Hungary and Czechoslovakia. Mm-hmm. And there was always this little thing that got said about my grandmother, which I just thought was a joke, which was, you know, grandma's kind of a witch. And I didn't get to realize everything that my father was doing in the background.
Uh-huh.
But he would say things like, oh, I'm not going to the doctor. I broke this. I'll fix it. You know, it's right. I'll figure out something. So there's a way in which, outside of the tradition that I thought I grew up in, that I'm at least third generation of some other tradition, which unfolded in my life in an equally strange walkabout, which right. is still happening. But one of the bits and pieces of that is when I look at your face, uh-huh. I see some of my relatives.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me. I don't know that I have Jewish background, but it really would not surprise me because the Sephardim were all over Spain.
Right.
So, you know.
So yeah. Just in terms of what you were saying about the small pockets of traditions that nobody knew were going on, and who's connected to whom and why and what the historical forces were that had people that had a Gaelic background be in mm-hmm. Spain, or people that were in Spain wind up in Eastern Europe, is just fascinating to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
great.
Well, Andras Corbin Arthin is our guest tonight, and thank you so much. I'm so glad that we got to do this. I'm looking forward to meeting you in person at that event in Northampton and continuing the conversation and seeing where else we can go with this.
My pleasure, David.
I think you've, in many ways, clarified a very vexing question about, you know, what is this paganism yeah. stuff? And you know, not that you can really define it, but you gave a really wonderful way of understanding this, and I really appreciate that. Great. So thank you so much for being with me.
My pleasure.
So this has been another wonderful evening. Just want to remind you, if you got curious about my work at all, you can get more information at househealing.com, and cleverly hiding on the contact tab is every technology for getting in touch with me, including my online scheduling calendar. I do a free 20-minute reading and assessment of what's going on with, you know, a place, a person, a situation, whatever it happens to be, to see how my work might be helpful. So please, if there's anything going on, check it out and get in touch. The entire archive of this show is available online at thefarkasfiles.com, cleverly enough. And you can also find most of the shows on iTunes podcasts and a number of talk radio streams online. So I know most people listen to this at times other than when we record, and that's wonderful because I'm so honored that people all over the world listen to the show and we're a part of your life. So until next week, when once again we will do some fascinating things with fascinating people, this is David Franklin Farkas for the Farkas Files. The truth is in here somewhere on Empower Radio. Have a wonderful week.